Welcome to episode 36 of Linux Matters, a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. I'm Martin, and this week I have been theming your apps, all of them, with the help of cats.
I'm Alan, and I've been streaming to all the places.
Hello, I'm Mark, and I've been connecting my phone to more devices to see what happens.
In preparation to experiment with some of these sexy new window managers for that there Wayland, I thought I'd get on board with the cool kids with some serious, extreme desktop theming.
Two things. Are desktops sexy and are they new?
Well, I think the desktop, I'm not sure I can call them in desktop environments, the window managers that I'm going to be experimenting with in upcoming episodes, they do look very pretty. So, you know, you could qualify them as sexy if that's your thing. And they're new in as much that they haven't been around very long. So, and I've certainly never used them before. But what is also new to me is this sort of theme everything, sort of everything a consistent look and feel. So a few episodes back, I talked about like some chat applications. And one of the things I liked was using Fractal, which was a GTK4 Matrix client, and how it fitted in with the desktop, and then using a Adwaita theme for Telegram, so it fitted in. And I just liked that sort of cohesiveness. Well, I've gone one step further. Everything is themed. Every single little thing on my computer has the same theme, regardless of toolkit. And it is glorious.
I've never understood this, I don't think. On every platform I've ever used, there are applications that stand out as looking different. And my desktop, whether it's Mac, Windows, or Linux, is a testament to that. So I am the very much opposite of this. I don't go out of my way to make things look different. But they do because of the choices I've made. And I don't understand why it has to all look the same.
Because it looks good and it makes you feel warm and fuzzy inside.
Is part of it the challenge of overcoming the hurdles that you need to make everything look the same?
Yeah, to some extent. So in Ubuntu Mate, for example, I went to the effort of making sure that the GTK applications and the Qt applications looked the same by making sure that those toolkits presented in a consistent fashion. And it's a small thing, but it means that if you have, you know, VLC or OBS Studio or Shotcut, which are Qt applications running on top of Ubuntu Mate, they have the same look and feel as the GTK apps that make up the core of the desktop. And I like that. I think it's a little bit of quality. And so what I embarked on was taking a look at one of these theming communities and theming everything. And I have to say the result is really good. I mean, you say that your desktop, Alan, looks like a bit of a mishmash even on macOS, and I can believe on Windows. I think there's no help there. On my Mac system, everything does have a uniform look and feel. I don't think there are any applications I've installed that stand out and look different to like anything else.
The three that I alt-tab between, or Command Tab, or Cloverleaf Tab, or whatever it is, at work on a regular basis. Currently, Sublime Text, Chrome, Alacrity. None of those are themed the same. And so I don't get it, because I want the best app that does the right thing, and I don't really care what it looks like.
Well, I've got good news for you. You can have all three of those apps and have them fitting in with the same theme.
Okay, tell me more.
Okay. So there is a project called Cat Poochin, and it is a community of a collection of themes. So Cat Poochin itself is a series of four color palettes, a light color palette and four increasingly darker color palettes. And they are colorful, but sort of pastel, slightly muted colors, but they are well designed, well chosen. And this color palette has been published for themers of applications to then use. And there's hundreds of applications in their GitHub organization where you can go and get the themes for everything. So on Linux here, we'll start with the basics. They have a theme for GTK, and they have themes that you can apply to Qt via Kvantum, which is like this theming engine that is for Qt. And so immediately when you apply the Capuchin, in my case, the Capuchin Mocha theme to GTK and Qt, suddenly a whole wealth of applications just look the same all of a sudden. They've got this same sort of deep, dark, midnight blue, sort of almost black and sort of charcoal blue theme. And it just looks nice. I like dark themes, so I really like it.
Is it one thing you have to install that does all of them, or do you have to install the theme for every application that you have?
Well, so on NixOS, which is what I'm using, there is a Capuchin module which you can enable, and that does like 9/10 of what you need across absolutely everything, with a few outliers that aren't in that module that you can do by hand. If you're on other platforms, there's a lot of legwork and heavy lifting to be done. So once I'd got GTK and Qt done, I was like, right, I'm all in on this. So there is a theme for Alacrity. So this makes sure that the console terminal colors, so when you're running things like Bottom or any of these console tools, all of the color palette in those things match the background color, all from the same palette. VS Code has a theme. I've made one for Gitkraken. There's a theme for Telegram, Cider, my audio player, all the browsers. So all of the desktop applications that I'm using, I'm just looking around at what I have in front of me, not very many desktop applications, but they all now share this common theme. And what really sort of makes this sing is a whole bunch of terminal applications, most of which we've spoken about on this podcast at one time or another, that have these sort of pseudo graphical outputs. So things like Bottom and what else have we covered? I can't remember them all.
Atuin?
Yes, Atuin, Micro, Bat, Tmux, Delta, Fish itself, and even the Linux console all have pre-prepared themes that are in this Capuchin style. So even when I boot the system just to a console, that is themed with the correct background colors and the correct font colors and all the rest of it. So it means that there's this consistent look everywhere. And it just, the cohesiveness of this is just fantastic. I absolutely love it.
Meh.
Well, and it doesn't stop there.
Oh, there's more.
Yeah. Why stop with the desktop? Why not theme the internet? So there is a user styles theme for the Capuchin collection. And when you apply that in your browsers, hundreds of websites now automatically theme with this. So now when I visit GitHub or any sort of Wikimedia site or anything else, there is just this consistent in-browser experience as well.
So this isn't just setting like the default style for, you know, if you opened a page with no styling on it, this is overriding the styling that is then applied to various sites that you go to.
Yes.
Okay. Have you found that makes things a bit weird sometimes?
I haven't found any problems with it yet.
Okay.
And they are aggressively updated. And the way this user styles thing works is it automatically synchronizes with the new update. So as a site gets a fix or an update or whatever, they automatically, you know, propagate down to your system.
Okay. So people can do specific overrides for specific sites if things go odd as a result of some of the changes. I see. Okay. Yeah.
And there's a little button. If you think something is weird, you can just say turn it off and it's just dynamically goes away. I haven't had a problem. I mean, GitHub looks amazing with this turned on. It changes not just colors, but also glyphs and things. So it makes all the glyphs match like your local system and the web. It's just beautiful. So I've learned how to make this beautifully cohesive desktop environment, a little bit of bling and eye candy. I don't want to leave this behind, but I've done this work, so now I can go and look at these interesting window managers, which is the next step in beautifying my desktop.
I have been streaming to all the places that I care about anyway, via a magical new piece of software written by this here Martin Wimpress called Stream Sprout. It's quite hard to say that name. It's a shell script, unsurprisingly, and it's a front end for FFmpeg, kind of. And I used it a few times to stream from my computer running OBS to StreamSprout that was running on a remote machine. It could have been running on the same machine, but it was running on a remote machine. And then that machine sent the video to YouTube and Twitch. And that was all jolly good.
Sorry, I just want to check my understanding here. Can't OBS do that already?
I didn't say it couldn't.
Okay.
I'm just saying that that's the way I'm currently doing it. So the problem with doing it with OBS, or one of the problems of doing it with OBS, is you end up with two streams coming out of your computer.
Aha.
And I'm doing this at work, and the internet there is not amazing. It's okay. But I don't really want the overhead of my computer sending two streams to two different places.
Yeah.
Plus, Martin had made this thing, and I wanted to test it out. And so I send to one place, and then that one place restreams on. It's also quite convenient because I only have one button to press in OBS. I just hit start stream and it magically appears in two different places. So it's quite nice like that. The thing that's extra is that I decided to stream to a third place, which is Owncast. Now, I'd looked at Owncast in the past, and I know there was a talk at the last UbuCon in Latvia about it, and I've noodled around with it. I installed it, didn't really play with it, but I wanted to have a go. And so I set it all up, and it works, so I can send video from my computer to StreamSprout, running on a remote host, and then StreamSprout sends that three ways, YouTube, Twitch, and Owncast, all at the same time, all via RTMP. And that's great. But Owncast is running on my host. And because it's running on my host, every single time someone starts watching, the more people who are watching, the more bandwidth is going out of my host.
Oh.
Yes. So if I decided to stop using YouTube and Twitch and only streamed on Owncast, then I would have a bit of a problem because my box would be sending a video stream to a lot of like five people or something, you know, but it would be sending a lot of data, you know, constantly.
So, sorry, is Owncast running on the same box that StreamSprout is running on?
It could be, or it might not be. It doesn't really matter.
Yes.
Is the point.
But either way, it's your bandwidth that you're using.
Either way, it's my box, yes.
Yeah, and scaling is linear.
Right. So for every extra machine, that's extra bandwidth, the same amount again and again and again for every single person that joins watching, right? Now, Owncast is great, and it does integrate nicely with the Fediverse. So if you go to owncast.popey.com, you'll see there's an account there, and you can actually follow it on Mastodon or your Fediverse client of choice. And when I go live, it says on Mastodon, I've gone live, and with a link to Owncast. Yeah, it's really quite good.
Oh, that's really cool.
That integration is really slick.
Yeah, it is really slick. However, I was struggling a little bit with the bandwidth question, and I didn't really want to do a full bore test with it until I solved that problem. And I solved it by Martin saying, I'm sure I've seen a thing somewhere about how you can use third parties to do this. And so I did. I went looking for the documentation, and I found the documentation that details how you use a third party to cache the video stream. So there are plenty of these companies that do, you know, a cache you could put in front of your web page, but this is a cache kind of in front of your RTMP stream. And it's a little bit complicated to set up, and there's lots of different companies that do this kind of thing. And once you set it up and it's all working, it's amazing because it means that the Owncast server is sending the data out to only one place, the caching server, and everyone connects to the caching server. So you offload your bandwidth responsibility to this third party that you may or may not be paying for, or you may be paying a large amount or a small amount, depending upon how many people are watching and how often you stream and so on. But the tricky thing was, the day I came to actually set it all up, the documentation disappeared. And that kind of frustrated me a little bit. And the reason it disappeared is because the Owncast maintainer thought, well, maybe we don't want to be hosting all these different documentations for all these different streaming providers, these caching providers. Maybe we'll just give a general overview of how it works and other people can write that stuff up and keep it maintained in various other places. And so I dug out of the Git repo for their docs, the documentation that was there and that does actually still work, and I got it working. And so I was using a third party in front of my own cast server that was delivering the chunks of video out. And I was only sending them once to the caching server, and it worked really well. There was a little bit of a blip here and there, and I probably need to investigate re-encoding on the owncast server to encode down to lower bit rates for people on like smaller devices with smaller screens or poorer connections, because I've only just got one stream going to them, and it's the raw stream that comes from my machine to StreamSprout to owncast and then out to the caching server. It's one size fits all. And unfortunately in streaming, one size does not fit all. And so there's a little bit of optimization I need to do there. And I've learned a bit along the way, but I found it super fascinating. And it was super good fun.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because yes, I've obviously used things like Cloudflare and AWS CloudFront when serving web applications and, you know, sometimes big assets like videos and stuff like that, but not, I'd never really thought of it as applicable to streaming in this way.
Right. I hadn't. And then Martin explained it to me.
And it's exactly the same as a web app, except that an RTMP stream is a first in, first out chunk of data. So the file that sits in the S3 bucket is only ever like 4 meg in size, and it's just constantly moving.
So it's like it's just cached to the last however much, and when you connect to it, it just gives you whatever is coming now.
Yeah.
Yes. Because all the clients don't need to be like super in sync with each other. They just need to get whatever's being thrown at them and they decode it and display it. Yeah, there is some optimization to be done there. Like I said, like having multiple streams. And it is a little bit convoluted to set up. You have to have a separate host name that the caching server can contact the backend owncast server as to avoid like a loop and it trying to connect to itself, because you've got to have the DNS pointing to the caching server.
Right, yes, yes.
And so the caching server has to have another name that it can connect to the backend with. And so there's a whole bunch of like, not super complicated, and the documentation was pretty good. And, you know, I managed to get through it first time and I streamed for, I don't know, 2.5 hours or something, and it was fine. I didn't get any complaints. But Owncast has its own little graph telling you when people are getting dropped frames or, you know, there's difficulty, and it makes suggestions on what you should do. And so I'm going to tweak it a little bit and then try it again.
So at the beginning, Mark asked if you could do this multi-streaming or simulcasting from OBS. The answer is no, but yes. OBS, stock OBS, doesn't have that feature. It can send one stream to one place. There is a plugin, a third-party plugin, that does work most of the time, but because it was only working most of the time and not all of the time, was why I started working on StreamSprout, because I wanted a solution I could rely on. And Alan was foolish enough to actually stream with it before I'd even done so myself. And I still haven't. So Alan is the trailblazer.
I am patient zero.
I'm banging out code and he's off to the races. But yeah, it's a very simple tool. It just wraps up FFmpeg to do multi-streaming via RTMP.
The other thing it's worth noting is, yes, you can use third-party services like Restream. Like Restream is a service that you can pay for where you send the video to them and they restream. It's like StreamSprout and they send it on, but that's a paid service. The free one only goes to 2 locations and it has a watermark. You have to pay to be able to send it to 3 or more locations and get rid of the watermark. And so you can run StreamSprout on a separate machine from the one that you're actually streaming on. Because if you're streaming a game, for example, you might have the overhead of the game on your local machine and OBS sending that data to, you know, the internet. And if you've got a separate machine, which could just be a laptop, it doesn't have to be anything special because it's not actually doing any re-encoding. It's just literally taking bits in and sending bits out.
Yeah, I have used Restream and Live Push. So I started with those And the restreaming features of both of those platforms work brilliantly. You get your data to all of the platforms you want to stream to. However, they're too clever. They've got integrations to automatically like update your YouTube and your Twitch and all the rest of it and set all of your notifications going. And you can't avoid using those things, and those are unreliable. So I stopped using Live Push and Restream because I couldn't rely on them actually setting up the Twitch and the YouTube bits in the right way. So that's when I started using the OBS plugin, which then also let me down in different ways. So here we are with Stream Sprout. And what's interesting is Restream have got this clever bit of marketing saying that they'll watermark your video, which they don't do.
Okay, so I'll put a link in the show notes to Stream Sprout and to my Owncast server if you want to have a look at that. Oh, also, one thing I forgot to mention, I also created, because I've now got three links to share to everyone, the YouTube, the Twitch, and the Owncast, I created a separate page that's just popey.com/live, and that's got all three streams embedded in it. And so you just go to that one and then pick whichever one you want to watch, or watch all three of them in parallel if you want to.
Continuing my occasional series of plugging my phone into things and seeing what happens, I've spoken before about the fact that I listen to audiobooks, and I've got quite a nice audiobook app on my phone, and I also found one for my desktop. But I found that I wasn't really listening to audiobooks on my desktop, because when you're partway through an audiobook, switching to another app is a bit of a pain because it hasn't necessarily synced your position. And I don't necessarily have the chapters that I'm listening to on my phone on my desktop. And, you know, sometimes I'm listening to podcasts, which I'm also listening to on my phone. And I thought, wouldn't it be handy if I can just get my phone's audio to come out of my computer somehow? And so I had a memory in the back of my head of a tool called Scrocopy, which lets you basically mirror your Android phone into a window on your desktop. And I had a bit of a poke around there and found that, yes, it can forward audio as well. So I had a look at that and found that actually I couldn't use that where I wanted it because the version in Ubuntu and in the Snap Store. Well, no, the version in Ubuntu is very old. The version in the Snap Store wouldn't run. And I wasn't going to go any further than that in trying to get it working. So I had a bit of a search around to see if anyone else had an interesting solution to this. And I found an answer on a Stack Exchange website, which says, I'll just connect your phone to your laptop via Bluetooth and it'll work. And I thought, oh, really? I'd assumed that it was only going to do file transfer or something if I connected my phone to my laptop. But I tried it and I opened the Bluetooth settings in Ubuntu and opened them on my phone, and I paired it up and I pressed play on my phone, and lo and behold, it came out of my computer speakers, which was a huge surprise to me. I was mightily impressed.
Are we going to have another moment like last time where you were amazed that the output of your phone was mirrored onto the TV screen? Are we having another one of these?
We are having another one of these. Yeah. Yeah. I could just come into my office and pair my phone and say play, and it comes out of my computer instead of my phone. Or having to put on my headphones, because I can't plug the headphones which I'm wearing now, which are plugged into my computer, I can't plug them into my phone because my phone doesn't have a headphone jack anymore. But I can still listen to it on my computer at my convenience.
I'm looking forward to next week when you plug it into a charger.
It is remarkable that I have been doing the exact same thing at the exact same time, slightly differently, but almost identical. So I listen to podcasts and music in the car.
Yeah.
And as you say, you've then got that transition to when you get to the desktop and you, you know, pick up on your PC. So a little while ago, Alan gave me an old iPad, which I've been using at home as a control surface, but I took into the office. And what I did is connected the iPad to my machine over Bluetooth. And then a couple of extra bits and bobs in here, that mechanism by which it connects over Bluetooth is fine. I think on Ubuntu, this might be enabled by default. There's a use a service called the MPRE proxy. MPRE is the media presentation piece on the Linux desktop that enables you to do things like skip tracks and raise the volume in audio players in a sort of via an API. And what the MPRE proxy does is it exposes those capabilities that are transmitted from a Bluetooth device, usually headphones or earbuds, to the desktop. So on the desktop, if you say skip a track, whatever you're listening through does the same.
See, I don't have that working at the moment. I just have the audio coming out and then I control it on my phone. So I will look at that now that you've mentioned that.
Okay.
It's a possibility because that would be handy as well.
Yeah. So with the MPRE proxy hooked up, what I've then done is on my Stream Deck, I have used two command line utilities. One is called Player Cuttle and the other is Bluetooth Cuttle. And with those two utilities, I can control the volume of the playback of the device playing the audio, skip tracks, stop, start, pause, and all of that good stuff.
So if I launch Pavu Control, which shows me all of the audio interfaces on my system, I can see that my speakers are playing sound. And if I go to the recording tab, it says that the sound from my phone over Bluetooth is routed to my speakers. But the thing that I can change there is which device is routed to my speakers. I can't change where my phone's audio is going so that it goes, say, to my headphones if I want it to go through to my external interface and out through my headphones.
Yes, so that does work because that's how I listen to things. So I do know how to do it. And the system I have is the iPad plays the music. It's connected over Bluetooth to the PC.
Yep.
And then I am listening on my wireless earbuds to the music on the PC coming from the iPad. So it can all be routed. I can't remember how I did that off the top of my head, but maybe that is a topic I can go into in a future episode where I can unveil how I've got this weird Bluetooth configuration on my system.
Excellent. Well, join us next time when I plug my phone into my washing machine.